It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Since about 2009, the U.S. has seen a steady increase in the number of pedestrian deaths. That came after decades where the trend was toward more pedestrian safety. So what happened around then that made life more dangerous for us when we're walking? Our next guest looked at the numbers and talked to a lot of researchers. The puzzling thing is no one can give one definitive answer about why this is happening, and especially why such a large number of those deaths occur at night. We do have some insights about how we can chart a new path forward that makes the streets safer for everybody. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you walk to work or to school or to do errands? If so, do you feel safe with that nearby traffic? Or do you worry about possible run-ins with cars or other motorists? Does being a pedestrian part of the time change the way you think about driving when you're behind the wheel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Emily Badger is a reporter for the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy for the Upshot section from the Washington Bureau. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. Overall numbers of pedestrian deaths tragically going up, but a lot of that driven by what's happening after dark. What are we seeing there? What kind of trends are we seeing when it comes to those nighttime incidents?
So it's been very apparent to transportation planners and engineers that we have had this crisis of traffic safety, particularly for pedestrians, where deaths have been rising in the United States since about 2009, what you mentioned. But the thing that we discovered in this project that we recently published at the New York Times is that the vast majority of those deaths, more than 85% of them, the rise since 2009, those deaths have come at night. It is specifically pedestrians dying while it is dark in the United States that is really sort of driving this problem of worsening traffic safety. And, you know, that sort of takes this mystery that a lot of people have been puzzling over, and it makes it even harder to solve, I think. You know, we're trying to answer this question: what is it that is happening particularly at night? You know, what is it that has been happening particularly since 2009? And, you know, when we look at other countries, other comparable industrialized countries, they don't have patterns like this. So we're also trying to figure out, you know, what is it that is unique to the United States and our roads and the way we drive here that's causing more pedestrians to die at night?
People might think, okay, well, there's going to be one obvious answer. And actually, you did a follow-up column where readers suggested the obvious answer. But when you talk to a lot of the experts, there isn't one magical cause, if I'm reading you right, Emily.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to think about it. And, you know, I don't think it's that, you know, we just didn't turn over enough rocks and we never found the one magical thing. I think there is not one magical thing. I think that, you know, several things have been happening simultaneous to each other over these last 15 years in the U.S. And, you know, some of them are more obvious than others. You know, this is the time period over which smartphones become ubiquitous in the United States and they become this big source of driver distraction. You know, this is a time period during which vehicles are getting a lot bigger. It's a time period during which, you know, the screens inside of our vehicles are getting bigger and brighter and more complicated. So, you know, a lot of things are happening. And at the same time, we think there are things happening outside of the vehicle as well. We think that, you know, more Americans are moving to parts of the country that have worse infrastructure for pedestrians, you know, these Sunbelt metro areas. You know, the rise of homelessness is probably contributing to this as well, because literally we're talking about very vulnerable people who are living near highway interchanges and under road underpasses. So, you know, all of these things are not sort of deriving from one single obvious factor, but they may very well all be contributing to this problem at the same time.
Emily Badger stays with us from the Washington Post as we talk about pedestrian safety, especially at night. Turning toward Wisconsin, we've seen similar trends with a peak in pedestrian deaths during COVID. Things got a little better last year, though. Earlier today, I talked to Robert Schneider, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Here's that conversation. All right, I've been looking at these charts nationwide. Pedestrian deaths were going down and down over the years, and then we had this jump during the COVID era nationwide. Maybe we've gone down a bit in Wisconsin again. We'll take a look at that in a bit. But what were you looking at as you're seeing those numbers of pedestrian deaths going up again?
Yeah, well, it's a tragic thing when we have any traffic fatalities. And that's why a number of states and local communities are aiming towards Vision Zero, which is ultimately having zero traffic deaths on our highways and streets. But in the last 10 years, we've been going in the wrong direction. for pedestrian fatalities. We had a low of about 4,100 pedestrian fatalities across the country in 2009. And the most recent data from 2021, 2022, it's in the 7,000 range in terms of pedestrian fatalities. And when we look at the data, one of the things that sticks out is that many of the new fatalities that we're seeing, the additional 3,000 or so per year, are happening at night.
Yeah.
About 85% of those are occurring at night.
And we're talking to Emily Badger today, who's been reporting on this and breaking down those nighttime numbers. What are you looking at for possible causes in this jump in pedestrian fatalities at night?
Yeah, there are a number of things. I don't think anybody can really pinpoint a single factor, but we look in our research at some of the underlying factors related to roadway design and the characteristics of the system that we've developed. For example, the lighting conditions at night make it harder to see pedestrians crossing the street. So the average driver is going to see somebody slightly later and think about starting to stop at a slightly later time as a driver than they would during the daytime. That means there's less reaction distance and time, meaning the chances of a collision occurring at night versus daytime are higher, and the speed of the impact that happens is likely to be higher at night as well. So visibility is a key factor at night, and one of the things that exacerbates the risk is higher speeds.
Milwaukee is one of those cities that's aiming for zero pedestrian deaths, as I understand it, with a target of 2037. Are you seeing infrastructure changes coming into place that might help do that?
Yeah, there are a number of things being done by the City of Milwaukee Department of Public Works in collaboration with the Milwaukee County Department of Transportation and the Wisconsin State Department of Transportation. Many of the serious injuries and fatalities in Milwaukee are on main thoroughfares, and many of these are state highways. Capitol Drive is 190. Appleton Avenue is 175. There are many others, National Avenue, that have high concentrations of pedestrian injuries and some fatalities. And so actions that these agencies are taking are to do what are called rapid implementation projects. Things like temporary curb extensions have been added by flexible posts, but now in this last year, they've been making those concrete, which make it harder for drivers to pass on the right side of the roadway, which is a very dangerous behavior, and also reduce overall vehicle speeds, which is going to make pedestrians safer as well as all types of roadway users safer.
And let's wrap up, Robert, with a look at the behavioral side of things here. What should we as drivers be doing, you know, at dusk as it gets darker to try to adjust for the fact that, yeah, all of a sudden there's less visibility?
I think that one thing that we're often taught in driver's ed is to drive a safe speed for the conditions. And at nighttime, it gets dark. It gets harder to see. It's especially harder to see pedestrians, but other vehicles, bicyclists, others who are sharing the streets, it's harder to see. So you need to drive more slowly. As we think about it from a system perspective, we should also be thinking about, well, what streets can we have lower speed limits on that will reduce the baseline risk for drivers who are driving at night, and then the pedestrians, bicyclists, and other people who they may be interacting with. Ultimately, we want to create safer streets for everybody.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Robert Schneider, UW-Milwaukee transportation safety expert. I talked to him earlier about pedestrian safety, especially at night. Emily Badger stays with us from the New York Times Washington Bureau. I briefly transferred her to the Washington Post. She's with the New York Times. Emily, we heard from Bob there some of the infrastructure changes people are talking about to try to make pedestrians safer. Is that what you were hearing from experts you talked to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's helpful to look at what they are doing in other countries where they don't have this problem to the degree that we do. I mean, in most comparable European and Asian countries, for instance, you know, they have much lower levels of pedestrian fatalities, and they're trending downward, not upward. So the exact opposite thing is happening there. And, you know, so we ask, okay, what are they doing in those places? You know, they are not requiring pedestrians to wear neon-colored clothing. They are not, you know, requiring that everyone take their smartphones away, although they often have stricter rules about whether or not you can drive with them. You know, the kinds of things that they're doing that appear to be successful are really around infrastructure, you know, sort of investing in the actual physical roadway and ensuring that it's got safe pedestrian infrastructure, you know, that the speed limits on those roads are lower, that pedestrians actually have crosswalks, you know, that roads are designed to be serving not just cars, but also people who are riding their bikes on them, in addition to people who are walking on the sidewalk. You know, these are all things that sort of signal to a driver who's driving down the road, you know, you are sharing this road with other kinds of people who are more vulnerable than you, and you need to drive slower as a result of that. And, you know, some of those are the kinds of things that Bob was talking about in Milwaukee.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Hollandale. Karen, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be on the call. I live in Madison, about a 10-minute walk from the square where the Capitol is. And that means that every time I have to go to a meeting or go to business, I need to walk through what's called the Nolan Willie Street Hairball. And that intersection was recently under reconstruction for almost 2 years. It was not safe beforehand. It was incredibly treacherous, like a minefield, while it was under construction. And now, unbelievably, it is less safe. There are fewer physical barriers between us and folks making a fast left turn onto Nolan. And we have to dodge multiple lanes of traffic, a swinging right turn, and two lanes of bike traffic.
Thanks a lot for the call. Emily, I'm not going to assume you're familiar with that particular intersection, but is this seen as a problem? Weird intersections, that one happens to be along a lake where multiple roads run into each other at weird angles, a train track, a bike tracks, things like that. Are eccentric intersections like this seen as part of our pedestrian safety problem?
It's absolutely the case that, you know, we're more likely to see fatalities at intersections because, you know, intersections are complicated places where, you know, different groups of people traveling at different speeds and different modes are all coming into interaction with each other. And so, you know, this is part of the reason why a lot of communities, for instance, are pursuing laws that say no right turn on red. Like a right turn on a red is precisely the kind of condition that winds up having a driver drive into a pedestrian who thinks that they have the right of way, who's getting a signal that they have the right of way. And so, yeah, I mean, intersections in general, complicated intersections in particular, are precisely the kind of place where you just have lots of conflict points. And I think in general, you know, not being familiar with that specific
Sure.
intersection, you know, I think one of the things that has historically been the case with all of our road infrastructure in the United States is, you know, we've been asking ourselves, what are we optimizing for here? We've been optimizing to enable cars to drive as fast as possible, to get through the intersection quickly. And it's just a fundamental change in how we do things to say, you know, let's optimize for the safety of the most vulnerable people instead of the speed of the people who are going the fastest.
Thanks for that call, Karen. Emily Badger is with us from the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy. We're talking about a rise in American pedestrian deaths over the last bunch of years, especially at night, and why it's been hard for researchers to pin down a single cause. But there are, as we're hearing, some solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is it like for pedestrians in your community? If you want to go for a walk just for recreation or to get from point A to point B, can you? Do you feel safe? Is there a place to walk in Wisconsin, you know, on roadways, on sidewalks, and more that you feel is particularly safe or particularly unsafe? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Emily Badger from the New York Times about a nationwide rise in pedestrian fatalities starting around 2009 and a mystery why so many of those deaths, an increasing number over the years, happening at night. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions, maybe your solutions to this problem. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jay joins us now in Two Rivers. Jay, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm wondering if the popularity of pickup trucks and SUVs that have their headlights mounted higher, and the fact that the headlights are incredibly bright in some cases, unlike the old incandescents where they were limited in the light output, and that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And on one of your previous programs, it was commented how the bluish LED lights tend to affect our night vision for quite a long time after we get lights in our eyes. So I'm wondering if that's got anything to do with it, that we're just getting blinded by the light.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Emily, this is something that's definitely come up as you were reporting on this.
Yeah, I mean, after we published this story, and this headlights in particular were not something we discussed in the story, we heard from hundreds of readers who said, I think it's LED headlights. You know, the timeline is sort of fits relatively well. They also, you know, sort of come onto the market and become quite common after this 2009 time period that we're talking about. And, you know, they are much brighter. It is absolutely true that they're brighter than previous incandescent headlights that people had. But in my conversations with a lot of different researchers about this, and including researchers who specifically study headlights and exactly how, you know, they affect people's vision, you know, there's a sense that in many ways headlights are getting better. You know, I think the fear is that they're, you know, in some ways they're getting worse because they create more glare and they're particularly a problem for oncoming vehicles or even pedestrians who get blinded by them. But the general sense in the industry is that, you know, headlights are better than they used to be. As they're brighter, they illuminate longer distances than they used to. And, you know, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which sort of rates headlights and tracks, you know, how good they are and how they're changing over time, you know, they believe that headlights are getting better, that a larger share of cars on the road have headlights that are better. They try to assess, you know, how much glare is produced by those headlights. So, you know, I think that they are part of the puzzle here, but they're not quite the, you know, the sort of secret missing thing that people are not paying attention to, because, you know, at the same time as they are becoming brighter, you know, in some ways that's to the benefit of drivers, you know, that makes it easier for them to see. But, you know, another thing that the caller mentioned is that these brighter headlights are higher up on cars because they're attached to bigger cars, and certainly cars being bigger is part of the problem also.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jay. Paul joins us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm a semi-truck driver, and I'm also a self-described urban planning nerd. I watch City Nerd and Not Just Bikes on YouTube, where they talk about European city planning and how pedestrians are given a much better chance in those places than they are in the United States. When I was an over-the-road driver, I would park places and walk maybe a couple of miles to get to something interesting to go and see. And I walked in a lot of places that were not pedestrian-friendly, where I was walking next to a guardrail and between the guardrail and the roadway, and it was kind of terrible. I noticed that European cities have raised crosswalks, and the motor vehicles have to go up and over those crosswalks rather than pedestrians having to step down onto the roadway. They also have fewer slip lanes, which is a problem for pedestrians. I just heard the caller talking about LED headlights. One critique that I would make of those headlights is that although the headlights may be brighter and safer for drivers at night, they make it impossible for a pedestrian to see whether or not a directional signal is on those headlights in some cases. I would also argue that on vehicles, the turn signals are a single LED bulb in the midst of a chrome-plated box with all these facets in it. And when the sun is shining on that, good luck seeing that amber light somewhere in there.
I gotcha. Paul, we're just about out of time, but you gave us a lot to work with. Thanks for the call. Emily, Paul's point about some of those European infrastructure things, including raised pedestrian crosswalks, is that something that people here in the U.S. are looking at?
Yeah, both raised pedestrian crosswalks and these kind of bump outs at intersections where, the sidewalk almost extends into the intersection so that the pedestrian is standing out in the corner in a way that makes them more visible before they even enter into the intersection. So these are kind of, specific physical things that we could be doing to the environment, but it's going to take a very long time to do that to lots of intersections and lots of streets all over American communities.
Thanks again for that call. Emily, in our last minute or so, you reported on this. You talked to a lot of safety experts. Did you get the sense in your reporting that a lot of communities around the country are taking some of these ideas and trying to run with them?
I think that I think that would be putting it in a way that's a little bit too optimistic, in part because, part of what we have to change here is not just our infrastructure, but a culture of sort of prioritizing driving over walking, prioritizing speed over safety. And changing things like that is difficult. It takes time. It takes political capital. And even in many communities that are sort of ready to try to invest in street safety and pedestrian safety, it's not going to be easy for them to do that, I think.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Emily Badger, reporter for the New York Times, where she writes about cities and urban policy. She was with us for a look at why the United States is a uniquely dangerous place for pedestrians and what cities and transportation planners can do to make the streets safer for everyone. And early on, we heard from Robert Schneider, UW-Milwaukee transportation safety expert, for a look at what's going on here in the state. Still time for you to share what you're seeing, maybe in your own community. Is it safe? Do you feel safe walking from one place to another? What do you think your community is doing well? What would you like to see improve? What's your solution to pedestrian safety? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org. You can stream live, and you can go back and listen to archived audio as well and share great discussions with your friends and family. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Wisconsin has seen a warmer winter this year, with many parts of the state seeing a lot less snow than we're used to. The abnormal warmth has produced the lowest average ice cover across the Great Lakes in the last 50 years. If you've been hoping for a more wintry winter, the weather forecast has some good news for you, with heavy snow expected for a large part of the state and colder temperatures also on the horizon. We're checking in on why this winter has been mild so far and what we're in store for in the coming days. Later, we'll hear from a reporter about how the weather's been creating challenges for outdoor recreation and tourism here in the state. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this year's winter weather in Wisconsin? Are you glad to see snowfall and some colder temperatures on the way? Have you been happy with a warmer winter so far? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. Chad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. How are you doing today on this Monday?
I'm pretty good. Getting ready for some snow myself, Chad. Now, my perception, and I think a lot of people's perception, is it's been a pretty mild winter so far. First of all, in terms of temperatures, can you put some numbers on the reality? Has it in fact been pretty mild?
Yeah, in fact, temperatures have been pretty much all above average since the first day of December. So you're talking almost 40 days now of temperatures, average high anyway, above normal. And then you think back to the last time we had the biggest snowfall in Wausau, we have to go back to Halloween, where we had a whopping 2.2 inches of snow. And it's been anything but since. So far this season, Wausau is under 7 inches of snow, and we should have picked up close to 20 by now. So, and that really exists for a good portion of the state as well. Rhinelander is under 13 inches of snowfall for the season and should have had well over 25 inches at this point. So we're going to get back at it this week and get back to a very typical winter weather pattern and get our first shot of the Arctic air coming up later this week as well.
Yeah, before we dig into what's happening, well, it's going to be hitting, I guess, southwestern Wisconsin already tonight. But before we get to that, Chad, what has been moderating our weather so far this winter?
Well, we've been under the influence of a very strong El Nino since early in the spring. And when the temperatures in the ocean, this is the Pacific Ocean that we're really watching along the equator, the temperatures are unusually warm, and that is giving us the milder weather pattern. When we get the air masses coming in off of the Pacific Ocean, those are very warm and modified air masses compared to when we typically get a what we call a continental polar type air mass coming in from the northwest. So that has been the one thing that we have been lacking is the cold air push. If you think about it, we've had more days with a lot of cloud cover and some drizzle and fog and stuff like that since the middle of December. And we haven't had a whole lot of bright sunshine filled days ever since that time as well. So we've been in that kind of milder weather pattern. And now in the last couple of days, last week, in fact, we had a little bit of what's called a sudden stratospheric warming event. And what that really did is allow for a break off of this cold Arctic air to come sliding down the eastern slopes of the Rockies. So that's what we'll be looking at later this week. And usually when you get these kind of weather pattern changes, they take several days to happen. And in that process of the several days is when you get the clash of the air masses. In the summertime, this would be thunderstorms. In the wintertime, the clash of the air masses is where we're going to end up with snow. And then the question is, are we all snow or do we see a mixture? And for this next storm system coming up tomorrow, this is all a snow event. And this will be the heaviest snowfall we've had this season. But keep in mind, the biggest snowfall total since the beginning of the fall and winter season last fall was only 2.2 inches on Halloween. So it's not going to be hard to beat that.
And that just reminded me, you know, saying we have less snow than usual in winter could mean, okay, there's less overall precipitation, or the precipitation we've had, well, it was too warm. It came down as rain instead of snow. Has it been one or the other or a mix of those two things?
Yeah, and you're exactly right with that. When we talk about the El Nino effects in Wisconsin, it's traditionally less snow than average. But if you think about it, our average high right now is 24 degrees. If the temperatures are milder than that, like they have been, you get a better snow to water ratio. You know, everybody knows that when you get a clipper system and it snows at 10 degrees, it takes a lot of daytime snow to try to accumulate. And we're going to, you know, tomorrow when it's 30, 31 degrees during the snow, it accumulates very quickly when those temperatures are milder. So on average, El Ninos not only give us a milder than normal pattern, but also typically less snowfall than average because of what you just mentioned, where we could have a little more rain, drizzle, and stuff like that as opposed to snowfall. But that doesn't mean we're not going to get cold snaps. It doesn't mean we're not going to get some pretty hefty amounts of snow. And both of those are going to all happen here within the next 7 days.
Talking to Chad Franzen, meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau, about a mellow winter so far, higher than normal temperatures, less snow than normal, and now here comes the snow. So, Chad, you know, we've been watching over the last week as this thing develops. Give us the track of this snow. When is going to be hitting who and how?
All right. Right now, the storm track is coming out of the Central Plains states. It started off as a low pressure system developed on the Front Range of the Rockies, and it has been producing some pretty hefty amounts of snow in northwestern Iowa, southeastern South Dakota, and kind of a rain snow mix around places like Omaha, Nebraska. This storm system has some Gulf moisture to work with, and the track of the low pressure system will be on a line such that it'll move basically through northern Illinois, far southeastern Wisconsin. And with us, with that kind of moisture, and we're on the north side of this, that gives us a colder wind and therefore mostly a snow event. And it is going to turn very windy as this system approaches overnight tonight, and especially throughout the day tomorrow, and the wind direction will shift back to the northeast, and that'll cause some blowing and drifting. As far as the startup, it'll come in southwest to northeast across the state of Wisconsin, arriving just around midnight in the southwestern part of Wisconsin, around especially in central Wisconsin, around Juneau and Adams counties, and then spread northeastward toward daybreak, right through Wausau and the Merrill area. And then the heaviest amount of snowfall will fall mainly between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. tomorrow. And then as the snow starts to wind down, we'll get those gusty northeast winds really kicking in. And then it's going to cause some blowing and drifting for Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. Snowfall totals expected for a good portion of central Wisconsin, mainly that 3 to 5 inch range. But once you get a little closer to Shawano and especially down toward Waupaca, you could get closer to 7 to 8 because there will be some enhancement coming off of Lake Michigan as well. But a good portion of the area will be about 3 to 5 with slightly heavier amounts east and south.
So 3 to 5 isn't exactly an epic, you know, blizzard. But Chad, you mentioned the snow and that wind as a combo. When we're out driving, that's still pretty bad.
It is, and you've got communities that are doing some brining right now in preparation for the snowfall coming in. And when you have this snow, and it's going to fall in about 31, 32 degrees temperature-wise, and we're going to hover near that for most of the day. So some of the blacktop surfaces will fare a little better because of their ability to hold in some heat initially. But as we get into that time frame for tomorrow night, the front comes through. The snow will start winding down, but that wind direction will shift. And then you start getting into what we would say a drier snow content. Humidity values will drop. And that's when you get into the blowing and drifting type snow. And wind gusts could exceed 30 miles per hour and get close to 40 by the time we get around to just before daybreak Wednesday. So I think road conditions will be okay during the daytime because visibility, while reduced, it's still daylight. It's those nighttime hours in particular, and especially the late night hours where you really have some problems with blowing and drifting, and especially on less traveled roads where they may only get plowed once and that blowing and drifting just moves back over early Wednesday morning. So that'll be the big concern with this storm system is more so the road conditions as we get that 3 to 5 inches for most areas. And again, as you mentioned, 3 to 5 inches in past years isn't hardly what we consider a snowstorm, but this is the biggest one we've had so far this season.
We've got a caller, Karen, who wanted to know, Chad, about global warming as a factor in determining, you know, warmer winters and snowfall. I know we've got El Ninos and La Ninas and polar vortexes and stuff. How does global warming fit into all of that when it determines what kind of winter we're going to have?
Well, in the past, you go back to hundreds of years, right? And we have the written record for the last good 150 years of weather record and keeping in that such. The biggest thing about the any kind of a climate change is what the end result is and what the effects are within not only this country, but all across the globe. So for this system and this kind of an El Nino versus La Nina, we get those pretty much every other year. It's going to be one or the other. So the climate change, when you're talking about the globe and the earth as a whole, when those kind of systems are happening, such as like this one coming up from the southwest, the El Nino and La Nina type conditions really don't have much of a factor in what we consider global climate change. Because if you look at the written history, we've had these El Nino and La Nina type events. Now, having said that, you take those out. Let's talk about what's going on with the world. The Earth is warming up. I mean, we're coming out of a mini ice age. So as these warmer patterns happen and the warmer temperatures happen, weather patterns will change. So in the long term, yes, things are warming up. We are starting to see some of the areas that were maybe not as warm as they used to be are not as warm as they were now getting warmer than normal. And that's kind of where we are on the global scale is that temperatures are slowly ticking upward in the overall scheme of things. In Wisconsin, just like an El Nino type season like we have right now, that means some slightly warmer than normal conditions. But again, that doesn't mean we're not going to get cold and snow. It's just that we're looking at some slightly warmer normal conditions that have moved in and across in this, let's say, context for this country. And that's where we're having some of these milder and warmer than normal winters. But on the flip side of that, El Nino and La Nina can really override and secede that. If you think back to 2019, we had a bitterly cold month of February, and that's where we had so many temperatures below zero for almost 3 weeks straight.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Anytime.
That's Chad Fradson, meteorologist for WSAW-TV in Wausau, with us today to explain why Wisconsin hasn't seen much snow and ice this winter and what to expect with a big storm on the way for a lot of the state starting at midnight. Coming up, we'll learn how the lack of winter weather has affected outdoor recreation and tourism in the state and whether this coming forecast might help things out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an outdoor winter activity that you haven't been able to activate so much this year. Do you work in tourism in an area that relies on skiing and snowmobiling and ice castles and other winter activities? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We just heard from a meteorologist about why Wisconsin hasn't had a lot of snow this year and what to expect with the storm coming over the next couple days. Now we're turning our attention to outdoor recreation and tourism and how they're managing without a lot of snow or ice cover so far. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As this has been a down year for your snow-related activities, whatever they may be, do you live in a part of the state that depends on snowy weather and ice-covered lakes for tourism? How are things going? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Keith Olig is regional features writer for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. He wrote recent stories about the lack of snow and ice in the state affecting snowmobilers, ice fishing, and other outdoor activities. Keith, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks, Rob. Thanks now, for having me.
You write about these issues, Keith. It's also personal for you because you write that you like to do a lot of this stuff. For you personally, how's it been going with outdoor activities this winter?
Well, on one side of the coin, it's easy. I go out every day and do some sort of recreational exercise, mostly silent sports. So running's been good. I've been riding a bike a lot, and a lot of my cycling friends are getting in a lot of miles. I live in Wausau. I work in Green Bay, but I live in Wausau, and I've gotten some ice skating in the past couple of weeks, but big time. Money-wise, big-time recreational sports have been taking a hit, like snowmobiling, ice fishing in the south, and other sort of the motorized sports. They're really hurting right now.
Yeah, talking about running and cycling in early January, that's not exactly what people are looking for. Now, you kind of called around. You talked to some outdoor recreation people. Let's start with those motorsports, the snowmobiling. What are you hearing from people who count on that?
Well, so I called up to the snow capital of Wisconsin, Hurley. There are hundreds of miles of snowmobiling trails up there, and it's not going on. None of them are open. So I spoke with Jackie Widower. She is the director of the Hurley Area Chamber of Commerce, and they are asking people to kind of consider pivoting. They also have ATV and UTV, trails up there, and, those are open as long as it's cold enough. So it's been warm. If it's above freezing, then those trails shut down. And then I also spoke to the Eagle River Chamber of Commerce. That's the snowmobile capital of the world. And they too, Kim Emerson, the executive director of the Eagle River Chamber of Commerce, said that their snowmobile trails have been shut down, and some of the snowmobile events, such as the racing. I guess there was like a classic snowmobile race that was scheduled for last weekend. That was postponed. They hope to hold that later. But Kim said that people are ice fishing up there. So both of those women were saying, there's a lot of hope out there too. And maybe with this snowstorm and this cold snap, those trails will get open and people will get up there and snowmobile, spend their money.
Now let's talk about some skiing, Keith. Now, I know our own Danielle Kading reported that the Birkebeiner, they're working on making as much snow as they can, hopefully to have an event on schedule. What are you hearing in the world of cross-country skiing in the state?
I've been less connected that way, but I'm just sort of like watching from afar, and it sounds as if their man-made snowmaking facilities are on point. And I think, a section of the trail is open, and I just saw a picture this morning. They had some snow up there, so things look white too. it always seems weird to me when I see like a cross country skier skiing through brown on a band of white. So they at least have a white landscape. It looks fantastic.
Talking to Keith Ulig, regional features writer for the Green Bay Press Gazette, talking about some difficulties for the winter recreation world here in Wisconsin with the mild and low snow winter so far, though maybe some snow will come along and save the day over this next couple of days. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Keith, you also mentioned lakes. I understand, you know, if you go far enough north, you're going to find some frozen lakes to skate on like you did and to fish on. But it's not a normal season so far for a lot of the state. What are you seeing?
Colleague Paul Smith down in Milwaukee wrote a piece that ran on January 4th. And boy, it looks like swimming might be your option if you live down in Milwaukee and Madison, or at least it has been up until now. I know there's some surfing going on. I keep in contact with some folks through social media, and they've been surfing off of the coast of Kenosha. But, you know, Rob, that's the beach area of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So maybe, hopefully, that'll get those folks going too as the cold snaps in.
Now, you talk to people who, as you mentioned, who own businesses related to this. How worried are they? How big a hit is this, or are they feel like, okay, snow is going to come, we're going to be okay?
I think it's more the more snows are going to come and we're going to be okay. Both of those people from the chamber said they weren't panicking. They had a good, strong, busy Christmas season, they said, you know, because a lot of people had made plans to go up there, like Eagle River and Hurley, for Christmas. You know, they just didn't take their snowmobiles this season. But I think if it hangs around for very long, that's when that's when they're really going to start to see a bite into the in the economy.
Now, your fellow Wausauite Chad Fradson was telling us about this snow coming, if it does come to fruition. Keith, what's at the top of your list? Snowmen, snow angels, skiing, what are you going to do?
Nordic skiing, man. Nordic skiing. I've been just aching to go Nordic skiing.
All right, and are there good places? What are your favorite places to do around Wausau?
Wausau has a couple of great spots. 9 Mile County Forest and Recreation Area is the main skiing area. They've opened some trails on an area golf course. And sometimes I'll just go out like on the Wisconsin River or some of the other lakes. If we don't get enough snow to groom trails, I'll just sort of bushwhack. But that's pretty tricky, you know, with the warmth. You don't want to – no ice is safe ice, mm-hmm. So you got to be really careful about that.
And then I want to get back where we started, Keith. You wrote on your pieces, I think, some safety advice to share for people who are biking in the winter when there isn't a lot of snow. You had a little incident.
Yeah, I've crashed a few times so far this year. The problem has been it's been hovering around the freezing point. And it's like in one ride in particular, the pavement was fine. Like Chad said, it seems to hold the heat a little bit better. And I just turned a corner and it was like glare ice. And I took a tumble. I don't have any safety tips other than just go slow, be careful, and sort of be aware that that's a huge possibility. I just have to go out, though. You know, I can't do... Wisconsin winters, I've got to do something in order to, you know, kind of get through this dark season. And the only way I've found the best way is to just get outside. So I'll take the risk.
Hey, we got a caller with, I think, a couple ways to do that. Just briefly, Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, what are you missing this winter or doing this winter?
Hi, Rob. Well, you know, in terms of what I'm missing, I think we can agree we've missed a good month of snow and ice for, you know, skiing, you know, both cross country and downhill, but also pond hockey, which I like to do on a nice frozen lake or ice patch. And I wondered what insight your guests might have as to how many more winters we can have where we will be able to do all that, you know, starting in December or so, and hopefully not having to do it in January. But
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. We'll give Jack the last word. Our meteorologist has already left us, but thanks for the call, Jack. And Keith, thanks a lot for sharing what you're seeing this winter.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That's Keith Ullig, regional features writer for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. He's with us today to talk about how the outdoor recreation and tourism industries in the state are getting by with limited snowfall so far this winter. Earlier, we heard from meteorologist Chad Franzen about the weather trends behind the lack of snow and what's in store with the snowstorm coming pretty soon. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, check out the game of chess with a Wisconsin competitive chess player who's going to share the basics and some more advanced strategies, plus make the case for loving the game. As always, you can join in with your chess stories as well. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we got lots of advice on buying, storing, and using spices. We heard from some of you during the show and some more on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joe writes, I store most of them in the fridge. It's dark and cool, but I've heard it's not the right thing to do with many of them. But then, Joe says, I've heard all kinds of ways cast iron pans should be cared for, and most are nonsense. But that's another show. And Britt says, I picked up this Italian grilled meat seasoning while visiting Boston, and the addition of juniper really makes a difference. Interesting. That reminds me, one caller told us about a meatloaf that was ruined by substituting a cup of celery salt for a cup of celery. One time before a family gathering, I remember my grandma made a spice cake. When she was reaching for the cloves, she grabbed its neighbor, the chives. Turns out onion spice cake, not a culinary masterpiece. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.